looking document. It's a health hazard evaluation report, so it doesn't have any of the grandeur that Tony's documents showed, but maybe. I'll try to provide some link of how some of these things might actually connect. And this is actually a document from the University of Iowa based on a complaint that the librarians at Iowa had made to the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, after which a hazards evaluation committee was formed. And what was the complaint? The complaint was that around 30 librarians were complaining of the fact that in dealing with a certain class of books, they were constantly suffering from kind of wheezing, they were sneezing, there was some kind of skin itches that they had, there was a chest pain caused because of the handling of the books. And these were not. This was not the first time that this complaint had been made. A similar complaint had been made in 1974. And what was the complaint against? The complaint was against, specifically, books that were coming from India. And this was, again, a persistent kind of a problem where a lot of them claimed that the problem might be that a lot of the books had pesticide traces in them. So the competing accounts that go into, you know, what the problem with the books are. So while some people said there was a unique or a distinct but indescribable odor, others described it as a moldy but not unique odor, while others suggested that there was an insecticide odor, and most claimed that there was a dirty or a gritty sensation on their hands after working with the books. I'll come to the question of why on earth were these poor 30 librarians dealing with so many books from India in the first place, right? Because every year, the University of Iowa was getting around anywhere between 3,500 to 7,000 books from India. The report, in this case, comes to the conclusion that the source of the employee symptoms really could not be identified and ruled out the claim that this was caused by pesticides. They make a set of very generic health recommendations, including, you know, keep your working area clean, keep your hands clean, wear gloves while you're working, all the usual very, very helpful stuff. But they do come up with an interesting conclusion, and they arrive at the conclusion that at least the sneezing part of it could potentially be caused by the presence of jute used in the binding of the books. Jute is, you know, an Asian plant fiber and known in a way to be kind of an irritant. If you read the report, which seems really innocuous at one level, there's a kind of almost a detective fiction quality to the investigation that's carried out. And it's not entirely surprising, given the fact that a lot of detective fiction, classical detective fiction, arises during the colonial period with a lot of anxieties of contamination from the empire. So if you take classical Sherlock Holmes stories, a lot of them are about, you know, people who have come back from the colonies with some strange, unidentifiable illness. So there's a kind of a repetition in a way of that racialized trope. But let me talk about a second allergy now. The image that you have before you is of Parthenium hysteriforus, or the Parthenium plant, extremely common, designated as one of the seven most devastating weeds in the world. The plant grows wild all over India, and it seemed to be one of the greatest menaces that causes immense dangers to agriculture. It squeezes grasslands and pastures, reducing fodder supply. It's toxic to livestock, and also one of the single largest causes of asthma, especially in the city that I'm from, Bangalore. Every asthmatic wants to leave the city because of the presence of Parthenium. It can grow up to a height of 2 meters, and each plant can produce up to 10,000 seeds. The name of Parthenium in India is interesting because it's also called Congress grass. And there are two mythical origins about why it's called Congress grass. The first one claims that the white flower on the top of the plant, when it moves in the wind, looks like the cap worn by Congress politicians, the white cap worn by them. But that really isn't the real explanation. The other explanation is that this Parthenium plant was a gift, an unwanted gift, that was given by the Congress party to the people of India. Now, the second story is a lot more interesting for me. And in a way, it takes me back to making a link between the 30 sneezing librarians in the University of Iowa and Parthenium, which is seen to be one of the biggest problems and menaces both for health and for agriculture in India. And what's the connection? The connection is this. Parthenium came to India in the 50s via American wheat, Mexican wheat that was imported into India. And this is really, in some ways, the backdrop of the story, and I'll come back to the books in a bit. On the 10th of July, 1954, Eisenhower signs the Agricultural Trade Development and Assistance Act, or popularly known as Public Law 480, or PL 480, and I'll keep referring to this as PL 480. What is the impetus behind the PL 480 plan? Post-World War II, huge surplus of agricultural produce from the US because of the nature of industrial farming. There's a desperate need for a market for the surplus wheat that's being produced by the US. At the same time, and this is, of course, the PL 480 was initiated by someone called Senator Fulbright, after whom the Fulbright scholarship is named. at the same time, this is the period, of course, where the Cold War is being fought. And it's being fought in various kind of forums. In Europe, it's being fought on the grounds of ideology. It's being fought through covert operations, things that you know about. In Asia, and Susan's work has, has illuminated this for us, it's being fought on the grounds of two things. One is the invention of something called development, and the second is the use of food. The reason for this is very simple. Asia, and particularly a country like India, is seen to be a prime ground where if democracy in India can succeed, and if India does not go because it's inclined towards a very sympathetic relationship to the Soviet Union, and if it doesn't go down the communist route, it will demonstrate the ability of a modernized democratic form of development as initiated by a rule of expertise brought about by the US. So the domain of food becomes very, very crucial. Nick Carter, in his book, The Hungry World, an absolute must read, documents the use of food politics as key in the ideological battle of the Cold War in Asia. And he says that Kennedy, for example, was someone who recognized very instinctively the symbolic importance of India because of the fact of what they needed, and he quotes this, the need for a very large and a very poor country, right? So development needs a laboratory of that scale, which if it succeeds becomes an incredible, incredible kind of symbolic victory. Orville Freeman, the agricultural secretary for food in 1966 said, food and the ability to produce it and the means of teaching others to produce it are the most powerful weapons that America possesses. Later, Lyndon Johnson would say, we know that a grain of wheat is a potent weapon in the arsenal of freedom. What was the need for food in the Indian context? After the partition, where a lot of the extremely rich agricultural lands of West Punjab, known as kind of the rice and the wheat bowl of India, goes to Pakistan, there's already a food shortage. This is followed by 3 years of bad monsoons, resulting in famines and a food crisis of a very, very, very serious order in India. India didn't have enough foreign currency to buy food, even if it was available. And that's when the PL 480 comes into place. And incidentally, the PL 480 is only, India is just one of the laboratories. After that, it globalizes itself all across the world, across Asia, Latin America, and Africa. $100 million plus is loaned to India for India to be able to buy wheat from the US. The terms of the condition are very crucial. The terms of the condition is that the money will be stored or repayable in Indian currency. In other words, the US then managed to hold a very, very large, at one point of time, reaching up to $3.5 billion in Indian currency. From the Indian perspective, of course, this was very crucial for someone like Nehru and his chief planner, Mahal Nobis, where they wanted to go down the industrializing route. So if their agricultural needs were being taken care of and the food needs were being taken care of, there would be enough political stability that they didn't have to worry about it and focused all of the state's investment instead towards industrialization. This is also the time, because it's the Cold War, when you have something else that's happening, which is the invention of area studies, right? You know that from the 50s onwards, there is a huge amount of money in the creation of South Asian studies, Southeast Asian studies, et cetera. But one of the problems that a lot of the libraries and universities in the US had at that point of time was there just wasn't enough material. There just weren't enough books to be able to deal with, the demand of area studies. So in 1957, the Library of Congress organizes a conference, which is on American library resources on South Asia, where the challenge of building a collection and creating libraries is identified. And the Congress passes a resolution that some of the money available in the wheat loan interest fund from India can be allocated towards the purchase of Indian documents and books for American research centers. In other words, the money that is repayable under PL 480 for the loan that is being bought can be directed towards buying books from India. In 1958, Representative John Dingell successfully introduces an amendment to PL 480, inaugurating this idea of buying books, or what is known as the Books for Wheat program, right? That begins. Since 1954, from the time that India starts taking the loan and repaying, the interest on the loan itself, of course, becomes a stratospheric amount. So there are two consequences that begins to emerge from this. A procurement office is set up in Delhi, which goes around the country buying up books. India is obliged to provide multiple copies of books to the US and to the Library of Congress. And if you look at a lot of books, any South Asian will recognize that stamp that you encounter. It's called provided by the Library of Congress under the PL 480 or the Special Foreign Currency Program. Any South Asian who's done research in any library in the US will be familiar with this PL 480 note. So you have a situation in which you have this incredible amount of books that are being transported to the US. And that, of course, is the link to the poor wheezing librarians in Iowa who have to all of a sudden deal with this jute and the allergy that's being caused. India, of course, on the other hand, has its own share of allergies with Parthenium being brought with American wheat. There are allegations that this was consciously done. Of course, there is no evidence, and the US has denied that. The second element of this, which is again crucial, is that if on the one hand, a large number of the collections of South Asia were created in the US under the PL 480, the other side of this was that this is the time in which there was a clear recognition that books along with wheat were the most crucial weapons of the Cold War. This, of course, begins with the European experience, where the entire exporting of books to Europe, and especially to Germany, as a part of the denazification kind of program after World War II, they take a lesson from that and claim that along with the entire exporting of wheat, we need to be sending a lot of books to the Third World and to Asia. Very interestingly, the phrase that comes about is borrowed from a phrase that was used in the European context. And the phrase is the need to satiate the hunger for books, right? So here are these two economies now coming together in this bizarre and slightly macabre manner. So on the one hand, the hunger of wheat, and on the other, of knowledge, and the two actually coming in together. In the 1950s and 60s, approximately 80 million copies of books from the US in around 9,000 titles are sent in 51 languages and distributed in different parts of the Third World. India alone receives around 8.5 million books between 1951 and 1972. along with these kind of state initiatives, there were also a number of non-profit projects or book charities that existed that depended on individuals contributing a bookshelf to be sent to the Third World. The most famous one of this is the Franklin Book Project, which there's a fair amount of work done on the history of the Franklin Book Project in relation to Iran and the politics of Iran. But if you find that, I want to come to this and then come back to this. Yeah. So this is, for example, another example of the Freedom House bookshelf founded in 1958 by the New York Watchdog Group, Freedom House, which allowed American donors to select a library or a dozen or so of classics. And what were some of these classics that were being sent? I mean, of course, a lot of them were Cold War propaganda, so celebrating the life of, you know, famous Americans, kind of Abraham Lincoln's life, etc., the virtues of the free market. A lot of that propaganda that goes. On the other side, it manages, through the PL 480 program, to collect extremely rare documents. And the reason I got interested in PL 480 is because this is the first time that I've spent a longest period in the US in a university. And while I was doing research for my ongoing work, I found that I was basically getting access to books that I just don't have access to in India. And I was doing it sitting in my room on a computer, just ordering whatever I needed. Where for the same book, if I wanted to do research on that, it would probably take me months and unsuccessfully at that, even to locate the book. So the huge collection, a lot of the scholarship that emerges in, as South Asian studies, so for example, a very important thesis done on the emergency in India by Maya Dodd, begins with an acknowledgement that this would not have been possible without the PL 480 program. I'm interested in how to make sense of the politics of this, where on the one hand, the self-fulfilling prophecy that these materials would not have survived in a South Asian context because of the state of the archives and libraries, and at least, thankfully, they're saved in an American university, versus the question which begs to be asked, which is that of access. And how do we think about the politics of a huge amount of material available only to North American researchers or Indians who happen to come up to, you know, come to an American university? The USIS, which was established during this period, was also crucial in terms of the establishment of the tentacles of this kind of Cold War propaganda war. In Southeast Asia, for example, in a single year, 1969, 2 million copies of books in 511 titles were sent. Now, one more consequence that has to be borne in mind is what is the impact of the sending of these large number of books to India or to Southeast Asia, etc. What it does is it effectively breaks the backbone of the Indian publishing industry. So there are a large number of companies that are set up who are allowed to sell extremely subsidized versions of American textbooks that the indigenous publishers just cannot compete with. So by the time the PL 480, in a matter of two decades, operationalizes itself, it basically creates the conditions for the monopoly of academic production in most parts of the world, completely controlled by the academic presses of the US, right? So this is an interesting, there are many things that we could talk about, but I just wanted to come to one context that I currently work on, which is on the politics of intellectual property, which also ties in with the entire, you know, movement towards the GATT, the WTO, et cetera, and where we start increasingly seeing the focus of the battle on questions of intellectual property. 4 years ago, a case was brought in Delhi by all the leading academic publishers, Oxford University Press, Cambridge, Francis and Taylor, versus a small photocopying shop called Rameshwari Photocopying Services in Delhi University, which services primarily the Delhi School of Economics, but obviously everyone else. The reason that they were chosen is their competence. If you want a fantastically produced photocopy that looks like a book, Rameshwari was the place to go to. The publishers filed this copyright infringement suit on the basis that the creation of course packs and the reproduction of full books was obviously a violation of copyright. Now, this is a really interesting instance where the students took the battle to the streets. They formed an association called the Association for Students for Equitable and Accessible Knowledge. The case went up to the Delhi High Court. We won the case before a single judge bench. They appealed. It went to a division bench. We won the case there. And they were going to, you know, there was a lot of question about whether they would appeal to the Supreme Court. And 2 weeks ago, the publishers have finally decided that they've lost the battle both morally as well as legally and decided not to appeal the case. This is a really, really rare victory. In the larger context, of course, this would not really happen. And in most parts of the world, you know that the use of intellectual property to control access to knowledge, especially learning materials, how do we tie all of these various stories together? If in the last decade and a half, one of the sites for the emergence of a radical politics has really been around questions of intellectual property and the use in a way of strategies, whether of piracy or of other forms of sharing, to contest and challenge the monopolies of such kind of, you know, knowledge controlling entities. The question that I have is that in light of what I've spoken about, I just want to raise the question of, is that enough? Is the idea of access as an aspect of leakage, which is to allow at least some of the material that resides in the locked up databases to flow down in a way to developing countries where it's not available. The question is that really enough? Or how do we understand this in terms of a much larger question of the kind of epistemic, you know, in hierarchies that actually exist? How do we think about the citational hierarchies and epistemic exclusion that exist as a result of the creation of the authority of knowledge in various areas? Most databases, the really interesting statistics of if you're looking for material on Africa written by African scholars in any of the leading proprietary databases, you're going to get a shock of your life, right? How do we think about merging these two domains of politics? On the one hand, an idea of access in terms of literally unlocking. But the second one, which really is about an implosion of the databases itself, an implosion of the entire knowledge and the authority of knowledge control that actually happens. You know, whenever one doesn't have any answers and there are only questions, you always end with a Zen kind of quote. So my Zen quote for you is simply this, reverting back to the popular, you know, flapping butterfly with its seismic wings. When a librarian in Iowa sneezes, there may be a famine in India. But when a librarian in India downloads a book, will there be a flood in Iowa? Thank you.
Oh.